Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Well, there we go. Starting in silence, actually. Without random comments from me and Molly Wood. Hey, everybody. Kai Brizdahl, me and Molly Wood on a Tuesday. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, our deep dive into a single topic, germane and relevant to the news of the day.
Germane and relevant. It's hard to figure out how to talk about items related to politics at this late date. However, turns out a lot of voting is happening. And by a lot of accounts, many of these early votes that are being cast by the youths, the youngs, the youngsters, the most coveted vote in America that never seems to happen. And so we want to do a deep dive into the youth vote and this idea that we are in a gerontocracy. No matter who wins the November election, the White House will be occupied by the oldest sitting U.S. president. Congress, the presidency, and the electorate are all aging. And so we want to talk about where that leaves young people and their political clout in our political system.
Oldest president, whichever guy wins, ever elected to that office, which is simply mind-boggling. But gerontocracy. Yeah. Do me a little word definition here, would you?
Merriam-Webster defines, thank you, producers, gerontocracy, rule by elders. And in this case, it really does mean specifically that our government is run by and often voted for by people who are older and getting older, right? The average age of a member of Congress right now is 58. That number has just been increasing since 1981. And according to a piece I read in The Guardian, typically congressional representatives right now are 20 years older than their constituents.
Man, that's crazy. Now, we should say here, for those of you in that age bracket who, you know, define gerontocracy, as it were. Don't at us if you know what that means, because look, it's not to say that right. I'm just getting myself deeper into trouble here. It's not that people who are seasoned cannot govern effectively, but the question is, are they representative of the American electorate and the American population, more specifically, as a whole, right? There is a chance that they may not be around to see the results of some of the decisions, some of the votes they are taking, which, yes, always happens. But it's a topic worth exploring. And so we're gonna.
Yep, exactly. And especially because, as I mentioned, that youth vote, you know, we talk about it a lot and it often doesn't materialize for a number of reasons. Millennials represent a huge, in theory, voting block. So anyway, should we cut right to it?
Let's cut
right
to it.
That's enough setup.
Go. You go.
Abby Kisa is a youth vote researcher with Circle, an organization at Tufts University, which conducts research on young voters. Abby, how are you? Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So what are we seeing now? You've been tracking youth voter turnout. What can you tell us about whether young people, and we're sort of generically speaking of like people under 30, how many do you think have voted early so far, and how does that compare to previous election cycles?
Yeah, thanks so much for including us in this conversation. I love this question you're asking about gerontocracy. It's absolutely critical, not only to strong democracy, but also to strong communities in the U.S. to make sure that a diversity of young people have pathways to contribute and lead. And over the past few years, we've seen extensive engagement amongst young people, led often by young women of color. And we're continuing to see that again in the 2020 election. So first, we have to start our conversation by talking about the 2018 election, where the oldest Gen Z and the youngest millennials set records in 2018 with the highest turnout since the voting age was lowered to 18 in the early 70s with the 26th Amendment. And this was largely because of the youth leadership we saw that year, where young people were mobilizing other young people. And we're seeing that again this year, where young people are making this election about their future and mobilizing other young people along the way. And part of this is registering other young people to vote. We're seeing numbers of young people registering to vote in higher numbers than before the 2016 election. In fact, In 32 out of 40 states for which we have data, there are more youth registered to vote than in early November 2016. Huh. And we're also seeing young people cast absentee in early ballots. So for some of the states that we are following, the key states where we think young people are most likely to have an influence on federal elections, you know, if we compare to similar points in 2016, we see, you know, vast numbers more young people requesting absentee ballots or casting early votes. And in some key states, sometimes it's 6, 8, or 10 times as many as the same moments in 2016. And if we want this to continue, then we need to make sure young people, regardless of their level of engagement in the election or regardless of where they live over the course of the next week, they need to have a reliable set of information, really concrete information about how, when, and where to vote.
Can we back up for a minute and ask you to do a little bit of historical retrospective here? Why is it that young voters traditionally have not voted in the numbers that older people in this society have voted?
Well, Kai, I appreciate how you asked that question, because when we look at the data, this isn't about millennials. It's not about Gen Z. It is about age. Yeah. And it is about our struggle, this intractable issue that we've had over the past 50 years since we did lower the voting age, to get more young people to turn out to vote. And I would say that this issue is intractable, and it has to do with how our elections and how we mobilize people to vote. And I'll give you an example. So, for example, in the 2018 election, we saw young people who had just aged into the electorate much less likely to be contacted by a party or a campaign, a political campaign, because they don't have a vote history. Young people reported to us that they hadn't heard from parties and campaigns a lot less than young people who had voted before. So our ability to really welcome young people into democratic participation is relatively thin and differs vastly community to community. Now, another example to talk about is the fact that, you know, we rely on K-12 public schools to be engines of democracy, you know, someone really smart said. But unfortunately, you know, we heard earlier this year in our youth survey, there's really only about half of young people who, about 50%, who are learning about how and where to register to vote in high school. And it's less likely to occur, you know, in classrooms where young people aren't on a college track, and less likely to occur in classrooms where Black young people would experience that. And so we have these issues of really ad hoc implementation and certainly dramatically unequal implementation of how we support young people to enter into democratic participation.
Right. Well, and then you have this kind of existing structure where you heard us say the average age of a member of Congress is 58, which doesn't actually sound that old. But when you think about our more well-known representatives, Nancy Pelosi is 80, Mitch McConnell is 78. It does representation also matter in that way? Does it sort of contribute to this sense of disconnect for someone in high school who's looking at Congress and thinking nothing about this relates to me at all except maybe AOC?
Molly, I think that is such an important point, and there's so many angles to it. I mean, the first angle is that, you know, we have the most diverse racial and ethnic generation is Gen Z right now. And these are young people who really want to see themselves in what they're participating in. So that's the first, you know, barrier to representation. The second, I think, is something that we saw a lot in the 2008 election. We've been studying this for about 20 years. And in the 2008 election, there was a sentiment amongst young people that then candidate Obama really understood people like me. Right. And so that's another element of this representation. And then finally, you know, one of the things that is unbelievably important when it comes to youth voter turnout is the issues that candidates are talking about and how they're talking about them. So first and foremost, you know, young people have this stereotype that they're voting just because other people want them to, or they're voting for a candidate who's like the cool candidate, which couldn't be further than the truth when it comes to candidates, because we generally find that young people are looking for candidates to make change, to have an impact. We certainly are seeing that this year. But it speaks to young people really wanting to hear about issues that affect them, that affect their lives of people who they love. And then finally, one of the things that I think is critically important, I absolutely think that if young people started turning out to vote more, then more campaigns and politicians would pay attention to them, right? And when that happens, we see the conversations that we're having about democracy and about issues of our democracy shift. And 2020 is a really excellent example. Look at the leadership amongst young people and the uprisings around the country talking about racial justice. I think we have to ask whether or not that would have been the center of the vice presidential debate and the center of the presidential debates if young people, especially Black youth, were around the country saying, demanding that we talk about this long-term issue that we've had in this country. The other thing that I think could happen if young people started turning out is that we would have stronger turnout into the future. Because one of the things that research has clearly shown is that civic participation is a learned behavior. Voting is a learned behavior. So the earlier someone starts to participate, the earlier someone starts to understand how to have a voice on issues that they care about, the more likely it is that they're going to be engaged further into life. And so that's why we constantly talk about this idea of growing voters. Instead of waiting until the last 3 months before an election to try to cram for the test and get young people to vote, we really need to start much earlier, because then we'll reach a lot more young people, we'll have a much more equitable electorate, and into the future will have a much more representative electorate in years to come.
Are campaigns doing and parties doing outreach, not just to voters, but I think, like you said, a representative electorate is also a goal. What about candidates? What about parties trying to find younger candidates and more representative candidates?
Well, I certainly think that both parties are thinking about this, and we've seen, you know, other groups really try to create pipelines to candidacy. Of course, the way that elections are set up in the United States, with the money that it takes, you know, and the network of connected individuals that you need to really support a campaign, that not only is a barrier to someone who's, you know, theoretically younger to have a network that can support you, but also, you know, it leaves out so many young people who don't have that, you know, economic wealth around them to build a campaign off of. So while we do see campaigns and parties reaching out to young people, like I was talking about before, they're reaching out to young people who they think are going to vote, have probably voted before, and who are voting like them. So some of this can't just be up to political campaigns and political parties. We need to stand up as a country and say, you know what, we want more representative electorate. We want more representative elected officials.
Yeah, I mean, I almost have to assume that maybe when, you know, campaigns talk about the youth vote, but the youth vote, nobody knows, right? We don't know for sure how the youth are going to vote. Like, there must be some aspect of control here. Like, maybe it's not a good idea to bring a total wild card. You could imagine some entrenched party saying, maybe it's not a great idea to bring this total wild card into the electorate. Maybe it's better for us if they don't vote.
You know, one of the things that we find challenging, I'll say, is that, you know, sometimes we hear some, you know, I'm going to just say speculation. In other situations, we might call them myths about young voters. And one of those myths is that all young people are liberal and are going to vote for the Democrats. And, you know, while nationally over the past 15 years, we certainly have seen a pretty significant turn amongst young people to the Democratic Party, you know, 36% of young people, 18 to 29, voted for then-candidate Trump in 2016.
Yeah.
And when you look at different states and different communities, it really differs. So I don't really think that it's very wise in the long term for a party to ignore young people and not pay attention to them, because, you know, if you're in a swing state, young people are there and probably voting on either side of the aisle.
Yeah. Abby Kisa is a youth vote researcher with Circle, an organization at Tufts University, which conducts research on young voters. Thank you so much.
Abby, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yep. So interesting.
Yep. Yep.
And not a monolith.
Not a monolith, which is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Also, that whole long game, short game thing that she alluded to in the last answer, I mean, we see that playing out right now in this election with a lot of the decisions that have been made. And I think it's really interesting that she and others approach the youth vote the same way, right? Long game. Mm-hmm. Long game.
Yep. Yeah, which is how the youth, which is how young people should be thinking when they vote, too.
Right. What's your horizon,
politics
man?
Itself.
Like 60 years, yo. That's what I got working here.
Is a long game.
Okay. Yeah. So, back in a smidge with Mailbag and the Make Me Smart question and your thoughts on youth voting and the way it breaks down in this country. Be right back.
All right. I'm super annoyed because I just remembered the one question that I really wanted to ask that I didn't ask, which I'm going to put to the audience, which is how hard is it to poll young voters compared to polling older voters?
Yeah.
Dang it. All right. So
have landlines
I'm going
to answer landlines. Yeah. There's a pollster out there. Somebody tell us.
There's a pollster out there. And I would love to know, because that is, I think, also the question that I have, which is, does anybody know how young people are going to vote or want to vote or have voted? And when we see these polls, are they included? Are these younger voices included? So if you know the answer, and I bet one of you does because you're all so smart, please email us. Yeah. All right. What you got?
News. So mine is a little bit in the category of headlines are important, but you got to read the article. So there's a piece in the New York Times today saying recession's silver lining. American households are doing better than expected, which is on the face of it true, right? And we've reported this on Marketplace and you've seen it in other places. Basically, what's happening in this recession is that we are spending less, we are paying down debt, our credit scores are going up, and overall the financial health of American households is not so bad, better than it might be expected to be. And in fact, that is why this is not 2008, right? Because we have deleveraged, we have paid down a lot of debt. Same thing for companies. They've deleveraged, paid down a lot of debt, and they're doing, generally speaking, better on a balance sheet perspective. So that is all true. American households are doing better than expected. But it's really important that you read this article, because the subtext is a lot of the other things that are happening in this economy that will affect households are going to get worse from here, because the virus is in charge of this economy. And I just want to make sure that everybody, when they read these articles that say, and especially as they will this week when gross domestic product figures come out on Thursday, and you'll hear politicians with an R after their name saying, it's the biggest economic jump ever. That is not the entire story. So please read beyond the headlines. It is not all sunshine and light. Yes, there are some things that are good, but there is much that is very bad. Thank you very much.
Yes. Really, the subtext for this entire article is for now.
Yeah. Yeah.
For now. Also, every time I hear these stories, I think to myself, man, wouldn't America be in a great place if people made enough money?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes.
I mean, what we're getting is a short-term controlled experiment in what Americans' financial health looks like when they make enough money.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had a little extra. And therefore, we're not living on the complete edge of disaster or credit cards.
Yep.
Which I believe that economic research papers will be written to the heavens and beyond about this particular period and what we learned when we gave
for
people
sure.
just a little extra cushion. Yep.
For sure.
I have been talking on this show a bunch about my evolving opinions about social media and free speech online.
Yeah.
And how, you know, what I've come to realize is that what we have is market manipulated speech and not free speech on these platforms. And that, you know, when algorithms push things they think are engaging, that's very different from just like anybody can say anything online, which is what Mark Zuckerberg still wants us to believe. So the information I was happy to see is picking up on this idea and has a great kind of proposal for how to fix Section 230 and specifically how to target algorithmic amplification. And what's so interesting is that we're starting to see people, because we're, you know, tomorrow we're going to see our gerontocracy in action when the Senate, a Senate committee questions again the CEOs of Facebook, Twitter, and I think Google. About content online. It's, I'm just, that sigh is like, oh, God help us, must we? But ultimately, what they're going to be talking about is not just what people say online. It's what gets promoted by a computer, because the computer decides that it will be so interesting. So it's a great piece that basically is like, it is time to retire these features. And the conversation is starting to be about the idea that the these forms of speech, disinformation, misinformation, you know, information that is meant to divide, that frankly, like, influencers get paid for, right? They make money. They can sell merch. Like, there's a whole financial incentive ecosystem here that is winning for everybody except consumers and democracy. And they're starting to treat this type of speech like a product, like cigarettes or DEET. And that if you knowingly distribute a product that harms people, there will be regulation and or consequences. And that in this case, the product we should be taught, and I'm just so happy to see that we've sort of finally are all honing in, well, okay, some of us are honing in on the real problem, which is not people talking on the internet. It's algorithms deciding you should see more, more of that. And that is the harmful product. And the more we, the better we do at defining that, the better we can target our response to it. Now, nothing that useful is likely to be said tomorrow, but
As long as we don't question about, as long as we don't get questions about how these companies make money, then I think it's a win. And I know that's pejorative and disdainful of the elders in Congress, average age 58. But come on, man.
I still love. I mean, you know, I'm not going to rehash it, but I still love that question.
All right,
Senator, we sell ads. We don't care about your community. Okay, the end. Sorry, mailbag.
Mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai. Hello.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Long-time listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, so we went out on social and on the pod the last couple of days and asked first-time voters under the age of 30 to tell us what are the issues driving them to the polls this year. 26-year-old Gray is in Boston.
I was pretty apolitical before the 2020 presidential primary. Part of it was coming from, you know, military culture where you couldn't be vocal politically. And the other reason, which is, you know, I'd say pretty related, is generally being ignorant of how to be politically involved. I got invested in a campaign last summer, and it showed me a lot of why voting matters and how to find and actually support groups who are working on issues I care about. After doing that, I realized, like, you know, voting really is the first step in communicating your political voice, and I learned how to do some of that effectively. Anyway, thanks for your time, and would love to dive deeper on some of this with you.
Interesting. All right. Fair enough.
I love it.
Fair enough.
I love also that he's like, have me on.
Yeah. Got to make the pitch, man.
No, totally. Oh, my God. I'm already so excited about these voice memos. We have another one from another first-time voter.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Javier from Gainesville, Florida. I'm a youth voter who will be voting for the first time in this election, and that is because this is the first election for which I am a citizen and therefore allowed to vote. I'm really excited to get out there to the polls, and thank you guys for making us smart.
Yeah, can you imagine the frustration of people who are in the occasionally very long green card slash citizenship queue and see things happening that affect them and yet can't vote? And look, for you know, legit statutory reasons and all that, but it's got to be immensely frustrating. And then so gratifying now to be able to weigh in and express your political voice.
I know, totally. Yeah. Side note on that, in fact, apparently newly naturalized citizens are one of the fastest growing voting groups in the United States. In fact, Pew Research Center, thanks producers, estimated earlier this year that 23 million naturalized citizens would be eligible to vote in this election, which is almost double from 2000.
Which totally makes sense, right? I mean, you finally get the franchise, you're going to exercise it. Okay, last voice memo from a young voter. Here you go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. My name is Olivia. I'm in Memphis right now. I'm 21, voting in my first presidential election. Previous to this, there's just a lot of logistical things that had to happen for me to be able to vote, between making sure my absentee ballot is sent to the right address Also, finding a stamp. What 20-year-old has a stamp?
I oh asked. Oh my God!
Totally true.
None of totally us. True. None of us have stamps. None of us. So that was fun. My roommates and I had to run around out to the post office to pick up a stamp totally in the true. Middle of midterms, which was terrible. I'm voting right now because I am tired and I'm angry. And I would like to try and fix some of the things that I had trusted older people in this country to properly deal with. And they haven't. So now I have to try and fix it. But I'm doing my best. Thank you so much. I love the pod.
Yeah.
I love everything about this.
Yeah. Yeah. The turn to humor in the middle and then the dead serious turn at the end. Because old people, and look, I understand that young people in this society, in this economy, have been saying this for a long time, but old people have failed the youth. Mm-hmm. They have failed the youth.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So damn right they're going to vote.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. Also, stamps.
Right? I mean, look, it's a really good point. What 20-year-old
has stamps
lying around?
Do you have to stamp your... Because my ballot has postage paid. Do you have to stamp your midterm ballots?
I don't know.
I have questions. But these are the kind of, like, teeny, irritating little barriers, right? Yeah. Like, that just shouldn't... When the youth take over, they're going to be like, are you kidding me with this? Blockchain.
Right.
Come on.
That's right.
All right, we will now leave you. And by the way, thanks for voting, everyone. Yeah. I filled out my ballot last night, and then I was like, it's the last day to put it in the mailbox. And then my friend was like,
No.
I love you, and I'm asking you this one thing, which is drive it to a Dropbox. And
okay,
I was like,
good.
Fine.
You did that? Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm going to.
Okay.
This afternoon, my son and I are going to do that and pick up burritos. We're all excited. It's like there a voting go. Date. Everybody's making a party out of it.
For sure.
It's going to be wonderful. So thanks, everybody, for voting. It is... It's your right. Why wouldn't you? All right, we'll leave you now with an answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about?
This one comes from Leela Raju. She has been listening to this podcast since the very beginning, which is like going on 4 years now. Anyway, it's been racking her brain for a long time on how to answer this question. She's a doctor in New York. Here's what she came up with.
The one thing I realized that I thought I knew, but was wrong about, is that people did not trust doctors regarding the science. Maybe they don't even trust some of us now. I thought that even if you didn't trust politicians to be truthful, that you would trust your physician, who was there to help you stay well. I hadn't realized how much of that trust had been eroded over the years, making it easy for others to suggest doctors somehow benefit from lying about the severity of COVID or the precautions needed. And as we've seen, it's not just dying from COVID that is the only danger, but the long-term effects, even in cases where people survive it. Well, to make sure they don't bring back the dark sting just for me, I'll have to end on this. Ty, I can proudly say that I look forward to every fall just to get a pumpkin spice latte.
Oh, God.
And not to leave Molly out, but I'm not sure that anything with Coors can really be considered a beer.
Boom.
But I am glad you've discovered Porter's. Love the show, and thanks for making us all smarter.
Making friends and making enemies.
Come on.
All in one answer.
She's good. She's
right?
That was nicely masterful.
Done.
That was darn near politician level. I do not want to bring us back to the dark place, but listening to this made me wonder, and this would be an interesting thread to pull. I wonder how much the opioid crisis and the revelations that came out about how the pharmaceutical industry works, right? And how doctors are incentivized to prescribe certain medication. Yep. Like, I wonder if that contributed to a sense of lack of trust.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the medical industry overall, not necessarily the science, but like the incentives.
Mm-hmm. Well, and overall, as she kind of alludes to, the corrosion of trust in institutions, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. But I can tell you on the plus side that all the producers are also going to pick up burritos when they drop off their ballots. So I think we're just going to have like a Make Me Smart, like burrito ballot selfie.
That is awesome. What a good idea.
Situation.
What a good idea.
All right. That's it for today's show. Tomorrow is What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. I would love to get the answer to my polling question.
Mm-hmm.
we answer your questions and there is still time to send those to us via email. Words are not coming out right. At this exact moment, which is a bummer because it's a podcast. The address is makemesmart@marketplace.org. Subject line questions. We will answer your written and your voice memo questions. And we'll see you tomorrow.
We'll just answer questions. We'll just
answer questions.
Whatever they are.
Whatever form they come. Maybe some tweets.
Maybe. Marissa Cabrera produces and directs this podcast. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips does our newsletters and our smart speaker skills as well.
That is true, and is definitely going to get a burrito. Today's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez and mixed by Charlton Thorpe. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The senior producer is Donna Tam, and the executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves.
It's been a long time since I've had a burrito. It's been a very long time.
Go to my favorite Filipino food truck, Senior Sisig. Shout out to Senior Sisig, where you can get a burrito with an egg in it.
Oh, yeah. I bet that's delicious.
Because you can salag it, the only way to live. Put an egg on everything. So log it.
Boom.
Do.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.